Welcome to the Savvy Shrink Podcast, brought to you by MHNRnetwork.com. I'm your host, Andrea Schneider. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, therapist, and life coach. I will be sharing helpful information for individuals dealing with varying mental health challenges, ranging from trauma and loss to recovering from toxic relationships in love, work, and family, specifically as relates to narcissistic abuse recovery. Other poignant topics will include maternal mental health and special needs parenting, among others. The podcast welcomes guests who share their expertise in trauma-informed and evidence-based interventions, including the latest in neuropsychology. My ebook, Soul Vampires: Reclaiming Your Lifeblood After Narcissistic Abuse, is available at BookBaby and other digital online booksellers. I'm a believer in a strengths-focused perspective for my clients, which harnesses the power of internal wisdom and crafting the inner alchemy of healing. Please grab a cup of coffee or tea, and welcome to the Savvy Shrink. Welcome to the Savvy Shrink. We are thrilled today to have guest Carolyn Reinick-Wolf join us. She is the executive partner in the law firm of Abrams Fensterman and the director of the firm's mental health law practice. She focuses in guiding families through the complex landscape of legal issues that impact loved ones with serious mental illness and/or substance abuse. Ms. Wolf serves as a frequent source for media covering issues of mental illness and was the subject of a 2013 The New York Times profile article entitled A Guide in the Darkness. Ms. Wolf is an acclaimed New York City-based mental health attorney, and she's published a Huffington Post article about the holiday season support needed by shooting survivors and others in crisis and how their families can best help. So we're very thrilled to have her today. Welcome, Ms. Wolf.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate this.
Oh, it's just such an important topic, and we're really thrilled to have you here. Our listeners are in for quite a treat to learn more about all of this important information as relates to trauma and healing, and especially during the holiday season when a lot of that symptomatology for trauma surfaces. So we're really happy to have you and welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would like to know, and if you could share with us, what is it about the holiday season that sometimes triggers feelings of loss, anxiety, depression, and the like?
Well, it's supposed to be a time of being happy, of being joyful, of connecting with people, of sharing gifts, sharing stories. And so, you know, it's that holiday season, and certainly supported by media and advertising, and in a way, sadly, the commercial part of the holiday season, as well as the religious part and the interpersonal part, that often triggers these kinds of feelings, which really sometimes get overlooked in the course of the year, but are highlighted when it's supposed to be a time of happiness and connection and positive feelings.
Absolutely. I think it's a very poignant topic that we're addressing today simply because all of these types of triggers do surface very commonly for anyone who's experienced trauma or loss. And why is it often worse for those who've experienced a recent death in the family or traumatic incident? Why do you think that is?
Traditionally, this is traditionally family time. It's the time for making family memories, for families to come together, especially if people live far apart. It's a time when they all converge in one place very often. Families, close friends, colleagues you're close with. So it becomes very obvious when someone is no longer there.
Yes.
It's also a time when people share memories, share pictures, share experiences, and again, it just highlights the person who's missing from that exchange.
Absolutely.
So because it becomes so obvious, it's just that much more difficult and hurtful, and that feeling of loss, you know, just really comes to the surface usually at that time.
I agree completely. I see that often in my practice, and it seems that this time of year brings about a lot of raw emotion for many. So this time of year is definitely a tender time of year for many And in the Huffington Post article that you wrote, which was absolutely incredibly articulate and so helpful, and I encourage our listeners to read that. We're going to include a link to that article. But Ms. Wolf, you point to the survivors of recent shootings in Nevada, Texas, and California as the walking wounded. And these shootings, unfortunately, have been happening with greater frequency and intensity, and it's absolutely horrifying. But when you mention walking wounded, what do you mean by that?
Well, as I was watching the media coverage of these tragic events, it occurred to me how we can account for, you know, sadly and tragically, those people who die. Mm-hmm. We know who they are. They can be identified. And the same for those people who end up in medical treatment, in an emergency room, in a hospital, in a doctor's office. We can identify those people, and we hopefully can reach out to them and be supportive. It occurred to me in watching this, though, how many people just left the area. Mm-hmm. Happily for them, they weren't wounded. They didn't pass away.
Right.
But certainly they were witnessed to all of the carnage and all of the horror of
right.
what took place. Many people left the area, or if they didn't leave right away, at some point, you know, they were going to go home or go back to the places that they live and work. And often we can't account for those people. They
mm-hmm.
just kind of leave the scene. And so it's very difficult to track those people because they're,
yeah.
you know, basically unaccounted for and really unattended to.
Yes.
And so although they may not be physically injured, they certainly are going to be emotionally injured.
For
and
sure.
experience the stress and trauma of what took place, what they saw, who they were with. Often people lose track of those they're with for
mm-hmm.
a period of time and worry, are they still with us? You know, are they
yeah.
dead or alive?
Yeah.
So they're really, in my opinion, the same people who are wounded in a tragedy like this as those that we can identify and account for.
That's a really good point. And we often overlook those individuals too. And it seems as though for some of those folks, they may experience some vicarious trauma by hearing about horrific incidences that have occurred to other family members or friends, or even just people that attended these events and were injured or killed. And I think a lot of the individuals that have survived may also have survivor guilt too. And that certainly is impactful in terms of their recovery process and how they process trauma and releasing that sort of guilt as well. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm. We see that. And there are also, you know, people come with underlying mental health issues.
Mm-hmm.
So you're sitting outside and watching a concert, you might have underlying depression or
right.
underlying anxiety or have a diagnosis of bipolar disorder or whatever it might be.
Right.
And so now you're adding the trauma of this. And we know that stress and trauma, you know, can be an underlying trigger
mm-hmm.
For a mental health issue. And so, again, those are the people that we may not be able to account for and intervene with because
mm-hmm.
we don't know who they are. Also, those people who are watching this unfold may have experienced a similar tragedy somewhere along the lines.
Mm-hmm.
And they're home now kind of reliving and rewatching what happened to them, maybe
right.
in the past. And so these are also people that we can't account for directly or who may or may not be attended to in working through the initial trauma that they experienced and now seeing others experiencing a very similar traumatic event.
Yes, exactly. I think that's very important to include those individuals in the circle of care and support that hopefully is available out there. But with that, the article says explicitly that family members often don't know how to help when their loved ones face these kinds of problems. And more than that, they're usually not the best mental health advocates, even if they're extremely devoted and their hearts are in the right place. Can you tell us what you mean about that and elaborate a little bit further?
Sure. I mean, this is the bulk of what I see in my mental health law practice. And
mm-hmm.
as you had said, we concentrate in my area of concentration, if you will, is with working with families who have family members who have serious mental health issues, substance abuse issues, related physical mental health issues. And so these families are usually just too emotionally involved to be able to clear the way for them to offer services to their loved ones, you know, their parents, their children, their siblings, their spouses. So you have the emotional involvement separate from the need to just kind of clear that or put that to the side for the moment in an attempt to help the person who is experiencing this kind of trauma or a demonstration of symptoms of an underlying mental health problem. They're
right.
Just too close.
Absolutely.
And usually families are not either trained in working, you know, in the mental health field, or even if they're trained, they should not be treating their own.
Mm-hmm.
You may be able to do this professionally, but I don't recommend that you become the professional in the life of a loved one.
Absolutely.
And so we work very hard to actually make families go back to their real roles, being the mom, the dad, the sister, brother, the spouse, and take them out of the role of now becoming the therapist or the nurse or the social worker, the financial manager, the caretaker. And we offer, you know, a whole host of professionals, as my collaborative practice is set up to use, in order to put them in the middle between the person who's suffering and the family member who wants to get them the help that they need.
That sounds fantastic. A very comprehensive service that's available. I wish you were out in California, but it just sounds like such an incredible service. So helpful.
Yes, that all the time.
Oh, yeah. It's so needed. And it's wonderful that there is a fantastic attorney out there that is so nuanced in the subtleties of mental health and can be very complex. So it's just wonderful that you've specialized in this area because there is such a need. And we certainly live in an area where there's a lot of trauma happening on many levels, whether it be politically or whether it be gun violence or what have you. There's so many different layers of trauma that I think our country, for the first time in many years, is just being compounded with, in addition to trauma that can arise from relational trauma or depression, anxiety, etc. So it's a very complex world.
We're seeing a lot of that, and it is complex. One of the advantages that I have in this kind of practice is I actually was a hospital administrator and a hospital risk manager before I became an attorney. And so I have a very good healthcare background and comprehensive healthcare systems background. So it's very helpful for me to understand what the medical professionals do, what a medical facility looks like. I know what an emergency room looks like. I know what an admitting office does. Families often ask when they have loved ones who are hospitalized, who do I contact if I'm upset with something or need information? And so, you know, I know who those point people are, whether it's a patient relations person or a risk manager or an administrator. And so I work a lot in helping families just navigate through the very complex and usually not supportive and helpful healthcare and mental health system. It's underfunded, understaffed. It's very overwhelming for families in the midst of a crisis or in trying to get help for a loved one to sort out who to go to and who to seek advice from. So we work closely with our families to give them that information and guidance as well.
That's just so incredibly helpful and more relevant and poignant now than ever. I know in California, there's a lot of therapists that are dealing with clients who were exposed to or directly impacted by the Las Vegas shootings recently. And so there's such a need for people such as yourself out here in California, but just really all over the country and all over the world. And it's wonderful that our listeners get to hear about your services and what you do. A lot of times, family members wonder what they can do when they've had a loved one that's been impacted by trauma, whether it be a violent incident or potentially relational trauma or what have you. What should family members do if they see their loved one struggling this holiday season with mental health, emotional, or substance abuse issues? And who do they turn to for guidance? What would you recommend?
First and foremost, families should not suffer in silence, but they should seek professional help whether it's asking friends, other family members, colleagues. We really talk a lot with our families about the issue of stigma and getting past stigma, which unfortunately is still somewhat pervasive in the mental health field.
Yeah.
But we encourage families to get past that stigma, get past the, in their minds, embarrassment of having somebody who has a serious mental health issue and, you know, seek guidance and assistance from others around them in terms of who to go to, who to seek assistance from. And it's actually very surprising how many people really are in the same boat as you are, you know, or there. It's more pervasive than you think. Unfortunately, people do very often suffer in silence. If you can get past the, as I said, the embarrassment, the stigma, you know, which are many people's feelings and beliefs, and say, this is an illness. It's an illness like any other. If somebody has diabetes or a heart condition, people are not embarrassed to say, you know, who do I go to deal with my medical problem?
Right.
But sadly, because of the stigma that has been attached to people with mental health issues, people are reticent to seek out that kind of information and guidance. So we encourage families all the time to speak to your religious leader, speak to your medical doctor, speak to your neighbor who you know is having a similar issue. And that can be a very supportive and helpful way to get help for your own loved one situation. We actually, even though I'm licensed to practice law only in the state of New York, I do get calls from people all across the country and overseas about what to do and where to seek help. And we can, you know, certainly give them a roadmap
of
what issues need to be addressed, what professionals are available. We often will do the research to help people find someone local in their state or their city. In finding similar assistance. We're really the only practice of its kind in the country, but I can certainly point people in the right direction or give them buzzwords or guidance on, you know, how to seek the help that they're looking for.
Wonderful. There's such a need for people to be able to access resources and have that roadmap as you talk about, because it is so overwhelming, and absolutely the stigma of mental health issues or trauma. There's such loaded words for so many survivors to bear that stigma of going in and getting support and therapy. But I really like how you reframe it, that it's just as important as a physical issue to attend to your mental and emotional issues, because we're multidimensional human beings. And, you know, if we're working on physical health, that's going to impact emotional health as well. So I think it's wonderful when there are teams of helping professionals that work together comprehensively, attorneys, physicians, therapists that can really provide multimodal support. And your program sounds incredibly innovative. Would be wonderful for folks in California to really learn more about, because I could see that being very beneficial out here as well.
Right. Well, we're very big on being collaborative. So I have a team of psychiatrists, therapists, mental health case managers, which are very hard to find. There are not a lot of them. And it's very hard to find someone who's good at it.
Yes.
Consultants who know of the different programs across the country and where to fit people into whatever their issues are. One of the big challenges that I see in my practice also is that there isn't a lot of quality control in this field. And so we try to vet programs, professionals, areas of assistance to make sure that they are actually providing the services that they say they're providing.
Good.
Or we will use our own clients' recommendations or people that they've had success with, or programs that have been beneficial to them, and, you know, keep an ongoing roster of those places in order to make referrals to those that we believe are quality, are practicing in the area that they profess to be practicing, and are programs that can provide the services they say they provide.
Good. That's a great resource. So if someone were looking for a trauma-informed therapist, what would you be looking for in order to vet them as somebody that is qualified to provide that kind of service for your clients?
it's either our own group of professionals who go to national meetings and make contacts across the country, the consultant with whom I work very often, who is really out and around a lot across the country, visiting programs, speaking with different professionals. So he provides a service that's very, very helpful and beneficial to us.
Good.
Sometimes it's the local medical association or the specialty association. It can be a variety of ways that we do that. And also the more calls we get from across the country, I always ask, is your loved one seeing a therapist? Who do they see? Has it been beneficial? What programs have they been in prior? When I get calls, we take a very comprehensive body of information, a very comprehensive intake, so that we know what direction we need to hit to follow.
Great.
The other thing I will say is, for my purposes and the purposes of my team initially, is it's interesting to know a diagnosis or a label, and certainly the clinicians need that for development of a treatment plan or a plan of intervention. But for our purposes, we're more focused on the behaviors and the symptoms, because that's, I believe, the service that we can provide most, is to analyze those, understand what the global issues are with an individual, and then come up with an action plan that will help them go in the right direction to get the services or the interventions that they need.
Right, right. It sounds incredibly comprehensive. And actually, how licensed clinical social workers such as myself approach things from a biopsychosocial standpoint and looking at all those different layers in the context of family, culture, individual concerns, etc. So it sounds like you really have an incredible comprehensive service. I know in California, there's a lot of clinicians who provide trauma-informed therapy. And when I'm referring to someone, I want to be sure that that therapist has training in understanding the complex nuances of neuropsychology and that they have some education on brainwise modalities, referring specifically to the works of Bessel van der Kolk, who's cutting-edge neuroscientist that addresses, in his book, The Body Keeps the Score, many trauma-informed interventions, which can include interventions such as EMDR, eye movements desensitization and reprocessing, expressive arts modalities, and other types of approaches such as mindfulness-based cognitive intervention. And that's a really wordy kind of terminology for listeners, but I think it's just really important for those that have been impacted by trauma or mental health or substance abuse concerns that they really interview the therapist and the treatment team they're working with to be sure that they have adequate training in this background. It's really important.
It's also important for people to have a starting point. We often will refer someone for an evaluation. Or there may be times where someone needs to be hospitalized in the midst of an acute phase.
Exactly.
To just know what we're dealing with. It's sort of the chicken and egg question sometimes.
Yeah.
A serious underlying mental illness that people are self-medicating with substances, substance abuse, or is it truly a substance abuse issue that is demonstrating symptoms of a psychiatric disorder? And it's really important to try and sort that out, again, so we know how to direct the person into the right treatment modality.
For sure.
Or the right program that can be of benefit to them. And also to educate the families as well as to what they're really dealing with. Again, you know, there's a lot of misinformation out there and set ideas about different topics in the mental health world and different illnesses. And so it's really important to have accurate information.
Yes.
And for the families to be educated as to what it is we're dealing with and then what to look for as we progress down the road to getting somebody the treatment and the intervention that they need.
Good point. And that leads to my next question. As a mental health attorney, what would you add to that in terms of what do you think families as well as therapists should know about navigating legal and clinical challenges from your standpoint?
Well, it's very important for certainly the mental health professionals to know the mental health laws in their state. These are state law, confidentiality laws, release of records, access to records, and so on. But I speak a lot and really firmly believe in how important it is to know the exceptions to these laws as much as it is important to know what the law is. Hmm. Every one of these mental hygiene laws have exceptions. They're often called health and safety exceptions. And so it's important to understand those because sometimes it's the exceptions to the law, not the law itself, that helps you intervene in a situation or helps you communicate better with a family or a loved one or another therapist. So it's important to gather accurate information, and particularly for families as well as the clinicians, because as I said before, there is a lot of misinformation out there about what the laws say, what a clinician can do, what a family's rights are, and so on.
Right.
So we also inform and educate families as to what are their rights, which unfortunately are pretty limited in this area. And then what are the rights of their loved ones?
Okay.
Often refusing to get help or let the family assist them or go into treatment. So it's important for everybody to know what their rights are. The other thing I talk about a lot, which I think is really important, is people often look for the legal answer.
Okay.
And keep in mind, the law can't address every situation known to mankind.
Mm-hmm.
So there are times where it's really the common sense answer that is the correct answer.
Okay.
And we find ourselves very often just taking a think out of the box or a creative approach to a particular issue and problem, because sometimes the law either isn't clear or it's not really addressing the situation we're confronted with. And so that creative intervention is often, you know, the place that we end up going to. And there are times, and I do speak about this a lot when I lecture, is playing what I like to call pick your liability. There are times when we're confronted with a situation where it's a decision between breaching confidentiality and, you know, a potentially life-threatening situation, and, you know, deciding which is going to give in the interest of the other. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it may not be the total correct answer or the letter of the law answer, but it may be a choice between breaching one part of the law for the greater good of the person who's suffering. The example we often use is, you know, breach of confidentiality versus wrongful death. Obviously, the confidentiality part yields to the potential for somebody or others to get hurt. We need to think about.
Definitely. Mm-hmm.
You see this a lot also in what are the duty to warn type of cases. We get calls from clinicians all the time where we have a situation where they're concerned that the person is thinking about hurting someone in particular, an identified individual, and the issue of whether to breach confidentiality and warn that person or hold on to the confidentiality and try and work with the individual, hoping that that situation never occurs.
I see. And so you consult with therapists as well, in addition to working with the families of somebody who might have a mental illness, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. So we educate both our families and work a lot with clinicians in terms of the mental health legal issues that they confront, you know, very often on a daily basis.
Sure. That's so helpful. It's such a need, and it's wonderful to know that there are people like you doing this kind of consultation and coordination of care. I think it's fantastic. And with that, when is it appropriate for a family member to seek the help of a mental health attorney?
Well, it's interesting because clients often will ask me, why would I go to a lawyer?
Mm-hmm.
I have somebody in my family who has a serious mental illness or substance use issue or on the autism spectrum that are having challenges in the workplace, in a higher ed setting, in a family situation. You know, why would I come to a lawyer? And my answer is usually, well, I'm kind of a lawyer plus. I have sort of a global, more collaborative perspective on this, and Often it is a straight legal answer. We use our mental health legal toolkit, which I can go over in a little bit. And there's a legal answer to it. That's why you would come to a mental health lawyer who's very knowledgeable about the mental health laws and, as I said before, people's rights. But in addition, using the collaborative approach that we do, I can bring in others from the clinical world or from the social services world to bring to bear what other services are needed. So, you know, the short answer is you would go to a lawyer because you want important and accurate information with regard to your situation. You want to know what legal options are available in the mental health field. And also, psychiatry is the only area of medicine that is so closely linked to the legal system. Be involuntarily committed unless it's pursuant to a legal standard. They can't be treated over their objection except by court order, so there's a legal standard for that. Issues of a person's capacity to give consent or sign legal documents, you know, is a clinical determination, but it certainly impacts on what we can do legally. So the mental health world is an area of the medical world that is so closely linked and paralleled.
Yes, there's a real tight connection there, and it's great that you have the resources and connections in your area to know how to put together a treatment team that can advise in terms of legalities, but then also to refer to high-quality trauma-informed clinicians as well. That sounds very state-of-the-art and rare, honestly, and I'm sure that the clients that you work with are just really well taken care of to be able to have that kind of comprehensive care.
Give it our best shot.
Yes.
And we also, what I've developed is what I call the Mental Health Legal Toolkit.
Oh, nice.
Which can help to summarize the options that are available in the mental health legal system in order to get clinical mental health input. So, for example, we do in-home psychiatric interventions, which are very different than the interventions you read about or you see on TV. They're very clinically oriented. It's a team of mental health professionals, case managers, a security detail if that's needed, and I'm there to make sure that everything is done legally and appropriately. Most states have a mental health warrant statute. We can get someone to a psychiatric emergency room by court order for an evaluation if that's what's needed. Most states, all states that I know of, actually have conservatorship or guardianship statutes, which sometimes can be helpful in this area. There are times we need orders of protection to get someone out of the home and into a clinical setting, utilize that tool. The whole involuntary commitment option when somebody is in an acute phase of their illness and needs to be hospitalized. And we also offer an array of wraparound or support services, a mental health case manager, who can sometimes be the first line in trying to engage with someone and work with them in a less adversarial and confrontational way to gain trust and to intervene in the family situation, sort of be the go-between and the advocate for an individual who is in the midst of a serious psychiatric decompensation or substance abuse issue and can, you know, hope to gain the trust and be the guide in order to get somebody into treatment, which is very often a very challenging place to be.
For sure. Wow. Sounds like such an incredible service and resource for families that are really, really impacted, and really appreciate all of your expertise that you're sharing with us today. And I'm wondering if there's anything additionally that you'd like to share as relates to anything we've just talked about, or referencing again your Huffington Post article about the holiday season and survivors of trauma needing support. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to the conversation here, just so our listeners can hear your wonderful words of wisdom?
Thank you. I can't stress enough the need for families, as well as clinicians, to be proactive and as preventive as possible. The earlier on you seek help and intervene with someone, the better the outcomes. It's really important to understand that these issues likely won't go away. And lay people can be trained to identify what I call red flag behaviors or issues of concern or people at risk, and to really pay attention to that, understand that, know what those are, and get help for a loved one as soon as possible. And that's what made me think about and to write the article about the shooting survivors of these awful tragedies, is that in most cases, those who were not able to be identified, as I said earlier, either, you know, sadly because they passed away or they were in a hospital getting treatment, but those who are, as we pointed out, sort of the walking wounded, mm-hmm. that there will be signs that loved ones can pick up on, whether they're obvious or subtle, that people may be seeking medical attention, but yet have underlying mental health issues that go with that, and vice versa. Being proactive, seeking to intervene, offering support, and reaching out to people who are professionally trained in this area to get help they need as early as possible, I believe can head off individual tragedy as well as community tragedies.
Wonderful. That's such helpful information. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise and your time with us today. And really, the listeners are in for such a treat to hear all of these fantastic bits of information and words of wisdom. And Ms. Wolf, can you please let our listeners know how they can reach you if they're needing more help, or how to get in touch with you if they wanted to hire you for your services? What are your websites? How do people get in touch with you?
First, let me say thank you for having me. I very much appreciate the invitation to participate in your podcast, so thank you. The firm's website is www.abramslaw.com. My email is cwolf, C-W-O-L-F, at abramslaw, abramslaw.com.
Wonderful. And we will include links to your social media, your websites, and also your articles that we talked about in the podcast today when the podcast is up online. So thank you again, Ms. Wolf, for joining us today with the Savvy Shrink.
Thank you. This has been a pleasure. And thank you to all your listeners.
Thank you for joining us, and happy holidays.
Thank you again for listening to the Savvy Shrink. For more information about this podcast, go to thesavvyshrink.com or visit my website at andreaschneiderlcsw.com. This is your host, Andrea Schneider. Until next time.